We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour, we'll be talking about the work of an unusual group of filmmakers, or perhaps we should say that the subject that they worked on was unusual. This was a group of people that were put together after World War II to film nuclear explosions. And we'll be talking this morning with someone who is himself a filmmaker, who has been involved in the effort to restore and preserve and make publicly available the work of this unit. Our guest this morning is Peter Curran. He is a documentary maker. He's made 5 documentaries on the subject of atomic history, weapons, and testing. His films are Trinity and Beyond, also Atomic Filmmakers, Atomic Journeys, Nukes in Space, Nuclear 911. He's also author of a book that's titled How to Photograph an Atomic Bomb. He's going to be on the campus tomorrow. His visit here, sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and also the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. He'll be giving a talk tomorrow night on the campus. He'll be showing some portions of his film, his 1999 film, Hollywood's Top Secret Film Studio, and talking generally about the subject. This is taking place in room 66 of the main library tomorrow night at 7. It is free and open to the public. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. A little bit more about Peter Curran, someone who has been working in the film industry for quite a while. Starting when he was rather young, he went to work for George Lucas and, in fact, did special effects work on the original Star Wars. Then after that, he went on to start his own company, Visual Concept Entertainment, and his company worked on literally hundreds of motion pictures doing special effects for films, including both Addams Family films, all 3 RoboCop features. The work was also seen in Men in Black, 13 Days, Beautiful Mind, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, X-Men 2, and a number of other films. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. So if it's a long-distance call, use that number. And if you'd like to send an email question, you can do that too. will-talk@illinois.edu is the address. And Mr. Curran, hello.
Hi. Good morning, David.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. When did you, when and how did you first become aware of the work of the man at Lookout Mountain Laboratory?
Well, my interest had started before I actually knew who everybody was. I had originally been interested in the subject of the atomic bomb back when I was about 15. I visited Japan, and we went to Hiroshima, and I was very taken aback by the what had happened there, and that had always stayed with me. Years later, I had, after working on Star Wars, I became interested in the subject, and I made Trinity and Beyond, and after that, around the film industry, I guess I became known as the guy who was interested in the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And during the making of Trinity and Beyond, I would write down the names of people. You know, when you're a filmmaker or involved in film, they have what you call a slate at the beginning of many roles of film, very much the same way that the film industry identifies what they're doing. A slate is the piece of information that goes on the beginning of the film, and it lists the date, what the role is for, and specifically the name of the cameraman who was shooting it. So I was keeping track of a bunch of the names. A lot of the footage that I had access to, from a place called Dietriac, tomorrow night Dr. Byron Ristvedt, who runs DTRIAC, is going to be there. And I apologize, I'm not going to be able to be there tomorrow night, but Dr. Ristvedt, who is an amazing guy who runs DTRIAC, has done a lot of work for DTRIAC, and who I didn't even know at the time when I was first working on my film. He was kind of behind the scenes helping me get this getting material declassified. But in any case, after I had made Trinity and I kept track of a lot of the names of the cameramen, I had a meeting with somebody at Warner Brothers, and it was about a film. I don't even remember what film it was. And after the meeting was over, the person said, you know, we have a guy who is working for us in one of our vaults in Los Angeles, and he used to work for Lookout Mountain. Hmm. And he gave me that person's name and phone number, which I immediately called, and after talking with that person, he basically kind of started letting me in on the other people who were still around, who had worked at Lookout Mountain. And at that point, I just started talking to all of them, and I thought, wow, this is great. You know, these guys are still around, and this was quite a few years ago. It's 1996, and I actually had a what I would call a wrap party for them. I figured I'd finished Trinity and Beyond, and then I wanted to do something for the guys who were basically responsible for that photography. So I had a I set up something at the American Film Institute, AFI, in Los Angeles, and we had a, you know, basically a big wrap party for these guys who, you know, had been around. Lookout Mountain had been around, I think, starting around 1947, and their operation closed down, I believe, in 1969. Mm-hmm. And many of them are no longer still alive. They've been they're old. they were very old. A few of them are still around, and at the time I was able to help connect them to the Department of Defense, you know, which is what DTRIAC is a part of. And I would say after that, I made Atomic Filmmakers, which part of which is going to be shown tomorrow night.
Yeah.
And that's basically how I learned about them and got involved with them.
So it seems that there are two, you have, in a sense, two interests. One is that you think that it's important for people to be able to see these images, see images of nuclear explosions, and get some sense of what it is we're really talking about, so it's not just abstract, mm-hmm. but also to honor the work of these men who, at some risk to themselves, mm-hmm. were involved in documenting the explosions of these weapons.
Right. Well, let me take your first point. And I have an interest in identifying, preserving, and restoring a lot of the footage. I think up until the point that Trinity and Beyond was made, many of us thought of nuclear weapons photography, atomic bomb photography, as what we see in, like, newsreels. Mm-hmm. Lots of dirt, lots of dust, lots of scratches, old stuff. You know, what I call almost like the curtain of deterioration goes in front of the film, and you no longer have, like, a connection to it. I think at that point my interest was in trying to bring it and preserve it and restore it so that people see it as if they were there. You know, that's always been kind of part of my interest is in saying you are there. You know, you have the opportunity to see what it's like, and not just view abstract atomic bomb explosions as something of the past. You know, obviously, since 1963, 1962, this country hasn't been exploding atomic bombs in the atmosphere. I think 1992 was the last time that our country exploded an atomic bomb at all. And since, you know, 63 to about 1992, they're all done underground. So a lot had happened in this period of time, a period of time in which I was born, you know, I was born in 1956, and the whole atmospheric testing had been done between 1945 and 1962 from our country. And it was a unique period in time. You know, it's a period in time which I don't think is ever going to be recaptured. You know, even North Korea, you know, everybody's up in arms about them detonating an atomic bomb. And then still they're doing it underground, just like everybody else has done for, you know, quite a while.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus, Peter Curran. He's a documentary maker. He has produced 5 documentaries on the subject of atomic history, weapons, and testing, beginning back in the mid-90s. And on the campus of the University of Illinois tomorrow night, some portions of one of his films, the documentary Hollywood's Top Secret Film Studio, will be shown. He was originally scheduled, apparently, to be here and can't, but there will also be commenting and speaking, another guest, Byron Ristvedt. He is Assistant for Nuclear Matters with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency of the Department of Defense. He's a geologist, has more than 40 years of experience working on nuclear tests and test sites and issues having to do with nuclear proliferation. And he'll be talking about current issues in nuclear proliferation. And then they'll be showing some portions of this film, Hollywood's Top Secret Film Studio. This is all happening on the U of I campus tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. And anybody who is interested in stopping by should feel welcome. And here on the show, oh, pardon me, I'll do one more thing, and then I keep interrupting. I want to give the phone number again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There.
Dr. Ristvedt, I can't, you know, state enough how important figure he is in preserving and now I guess I wouldn't say necessarily restoring, but he is definitely at the forefront of making preserving our nuclear heritage on film. From 1969, the collection, the Lookout Mountain collection had moved to a number of locations. When Lookout Mountain had closed, the collection, the films that they had made, moved to another Air Force base. Lookout Mountain was considered an Air Force base, even though it was a building up in the middle of the Hollywood Hills, in the middle of a residential neighborhood. This huge concrete building that would probably withstand a hydrogen bomb explosion was situated, and is actually still there as a residence. But it's a huge building in the middle of the Hollywood Hills. And it was considered an Air Force base, Lookout Mountain Air Force Base, up until about 1969, when it was decommissioned, and the collection was sent to Norton Air Force Base in California, and then it was moved to Santa Barbara after that. And at that point, I believe DTRIAC, Defense Threat Reduction Agency, was given the opportunity to house this collection. It is currently in Albuquerque, in New Mexico.
Now, it's my understanding that back in the late 90s, the Energy Department decided to start to declassify some of this material, and a number of these films were indeed declassified. Anything that was secret or potentially important was taken out of there, and they were made available to anybody, I guess, who wanted to see them. This, however, was stopped by the Bush administration, I believe, in 2001. So I guess here the bottom line is that there is a lot of material here that's in storage that's still classified and still locked up.
Yes, there's still a lot of material that is classified, although Dr. Risfit will know that better than I do because I don't have a security clearance. It was made fairly, fairly easy for me. I'd like to mention something about the declassification program,
sure,
which was set up. I believe, and I don't want to take all the credit for it, but I believe that the declassification program was originally set up because of when I released Trinity and Beyond. There was some concern over the film by people in the government who looked at it and said, "Hey, this movie has classified footage in it. What's going on here?" And the fact is that no, there was not any classified footage in Trinity and Beyond. They were very helpful in declassifying some footage for me. But just to give you an example of how something like that might happen. There's specifically one sequence where in the film where they were, well, I'm not sure exactly how to put it. I utilized what they called B-roll. B-roll is, you know, if somebody goes out and shoots a movie, let's show setting up a bomb, let's show exploding it, and they make it into a classified movie. But then, like in any film entity, you know, any film studio, you have what they call outs, which means you shoot you shoot more than you use, and anything that's left over is considered outs. And basically, the movie that had been used for some of that specific footage was a classified movie, although the outs wound up being unclassified. Mm. So I was able to take the B-roll, or the outs, reassemble them into a sequence, and I guess reassembling them into a sequence that looked like it was from the classified movie because it's all the same footage. The government at that point, I think, said, well, we're not really sure what's going on here, but we should really have some method of declassifying footage for the public. And they went through... you can find a lot of those films on the web with the Department of Energy. In fact, I have a link on my website to the Department of Energy's web page where you can look at the films that are available. I think they released about 80 films somewhere in that neighborhood, and sometimes films can be totally declassified because atomic bomb films are not necessarily subject to automatic declassification. I guess there are some things that over a period of time automatically get declassified, and there are some things like atomic bomb films which do not fall into that category of being automatically declassified. But in any case, that was all, you know, what had happened on Trinity and Beyond and then the declassification program. After they declassified or sanitize, and I think you had made a distinction about that earlier, you know, a movie that's declassified, they look at it and they say, well, there's nothing in here that matters, you know, that of national security. So in that case, they would just totally declassify the movie. In some cases, there were still things that I assume were sensitive, and then they would do what they called sanitizing them. They would pull out pieces of the images, or they would pull out pieces of the narration in the film, and then that film would be considered sanitized. After a while, I think when, and I'm only guessing as far as what happened, the Bush administration came along, and at some point somebody said, I don't know, why are we doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of, you know, was put out to pasture. The program was put out to pasture. But the films that they did declassify are still available. And it was very helpful to me as well, because I was able to make additional films after Trinity and Beyond, Atomic Filmmakers, Nukes in Space, you know, Atomic Journeys, Nuclear 911. These were all films that benefited from the declassification program,
yeah,
because I was still interested in the subject. It was hard to, you know, I wanted to just put it down and say I'm going to move on to something else. But, you know, the history of atomic bomb testing and the nuclear history itself is fascinating in the sense that you generally don't go to school, you know, a normal school to learn that. You know, the courses in regular school and colleges do not, you know, offer the grand history of nuclear weapon development or technology. And so that was something that was always interesting to me, and I just guess I just kept going.
Mm. We're about at a midpoint here. I have a couple of callers we'll get right to, and let me introduce the guest, Peter Curran. He's someone who had a career doing special effects in Hollywood. He, when he was pretty young, went to work for George Lucas and worked on the original Star Wars, and then he started his own company, Visual Concept Entertainment, that did special effects work on hundreds of theatrical motion pictures. He's also a filmmaker himself and has done 5 documentaries that have to do with atomic history, atomic weapons, and testing. And on the campus of the University of Illinois, tomorrow night, they'll show portions of one of them. The title is Hollywood's Top Secret Film Studio, which is about the work of the Air Force 1352nd Photographic Group, based at a place that was called Lookout Mountain Laboratory, which was actually in Laurel Canyon in Los Angeles. Was set up in 1947, operated until 1969, and had military employees, but also had people who were drawn from some of the big film studios. And they went and they spent time at the Nevada test site and also in the South Pacific filming nuclear explosions. For a very long time, this was classified, and a lot of the films that they made still are classified. But because of the work of Peter Curran and some other people, some of it at least has been declassified. And you can see it various ways. You can see it in his documentaries. And if you stop by the main library, Room 66, on the University of Illinois campus here in Urbana-Champaign, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, you can see some of that and hear some discussion of the issues raised. And again, I do want to mention that speaking will be Dr. Byron Ristvedt. He is Assistant for Nuclear Matters with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency of the Department of Defense, and he has more than 40 years' experience working on nuclear tests and test sites and proliferation issues, and so he'll be giving a speech. This event is sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, and also the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. And we do have a couple of callers here who've been patient, and we'll get right to them. First in Effingham, line number 4. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call, David. I wanted to start with the, and I have a couple of other comments, the film and pictures, if I understand correctly, is used and maintained for the shock and awe. And I was a boy when this first happened at the end of World War II, and what it meant to life on this planet. And if I recall correctly, the underground explosions began to occur when the atmosphere became undoable with that kind of stuff. And the last thing I'll say is that I recall the newsreels, and I was in my teens by then, of Harry Truman sitting, I think it was Churchill and Truman and Stalin, maybe one other, but Truman turns to Stalin's ear and tells him, "We have the bomb," which was before it was dropped in Japan. And if I still understand the ramifications, that there was talk of the international community that the U.S. should have been convicted of war crimes for what they did. So I'll hang up and listen. Thanks again, Dave. Mm.
Well, I don't know if anything there particularly that you want to comment
well,
on.
Well, in a sense, the photography of the bomb and the technical photography and the documentary photography eventually did wind up with audiences, the regular general public, and I suppose that one could say that at that point it was considered shock and awe. The original purpose of the photography was to document this what was going on for the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy. And, you know, it eventually wound up, yes, with the public. I'd also like to point out that, you know, filmmaking is kind of a method of communication. So, you know, you kind of get the shock and awe when you look at a bomb shot that is really huge in the frame. Also, at the same time, I guess towards the end of atmospheric testing, the government really wanted to portray what was going on with the atomic bomb is not as big of a deal. So, you know, sometimes they would do wide shots, you know, and they don't look quite as big in wide shots. And what happened at the end of the atmospheric testing phase was, in fact, yes, I believe it was true that all of the testing that was being done, and it wasn't just the United States. The Russians were doing a lot of tests. The Russians were doing a lot of big tests. The United States, you know, they were both doing a lot of tests, and because of it, I think scientists had discovered that the background radiation was starting to go up in around the world. You know, the Russians did some very large tests. Their largest test was like 57 megatons, which if you don't really know the difference between like a kiloton or a megaton, the test at, well, I'm not going to call the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki as tests because they don't classify them as tests, but the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, I believe, was about 20 kilotons, somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 kilotons. So, you know, 57 megatons, which was the Russians' largest test, it is just huge compared to the size of the test that, or the size of the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. The Russians also, at the same time, did a number of other very large tests. And these, I think the Russians like to do what I think I read somewhere, that they had this huge cannon. You know, it didn't really work, but it was big, and they like to, you know, they like to portray themselves as having the biggest. You know, the United States, at the same time, never tested a bomb, I believe, larger than 15 megatons. That was in 1954, and the reason was, I think, the United States had a more pragmatic view, which was, we know we can make them bigger, and but we don't necessarily need to test them bigger. You know, we know that if we do a certain size, it can be scaled up, and you know, something that's 15 megatons, they do something to it, and it's 30 megatons. So they know that they could do that, and didn't want to necessarily just go around blowing off big bombs. The Russians didn't have that problem, but because of all the testing that was going on, the atmosphere did become more radioactive, and 100 countries signed the Test Ban Treaty, which prohibited bombs being set off underwater in the atmosphere and in outer space. And the United States kept testing after that, underground, quite a few bombs underground, but underground nonetheless.
Well, let's go and take another call here with somebody here where we are in Champaign County. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. So much here. The atmospheric test, my mother was a teacher, and she was collecting children's teeth. She doesn't remember this, but I do distinctly, that, and they were analyzed for strontium. 90, I guess, radioactive. I didn't see how much of the atmospheric. But that's just incidental while I was listening on the phone. I was motivated to call because I wonder whether in your filming you did anything with the atomic veterans. It was the policy of the Defense Department, though there were papers floating around about the use of fallout. But at the same time, the policy of was that it wasn't that dangerous, and that consequently, many, many soldiers were marched up to watch. So I'm wondering whether you did something with them. In the category of films that haven't seen the light of day, there was a gentleman in this community, who African American soldier, who stationed mainly in China, Les McCall, if I recall his name right, who went in after one of the atomic bombs in Nagasaki to guard people who were filming the aftermath. That was actually somewhat of a bit of a test on live people, and the Defense Department apparently has this footage, and it's ghastly. And but I wonder whether you know of anyone who's actually trying to get that released.
Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
First off, I've done work with a group called Cold War Patriots, who are who are trying to help some of the veterans, and especially the people who aren't covered under covered as you have the difference between people who are actually enlisted and people who are basically contractors, who are not enlisted but work side by side, and contractors often don't have the same protections as the people who are who are part of the military. As far as the whole radioactive thing, I mean, they had a pretty good idea of what would happen, and I think even after World War II, the first series of tests, which was Crossroads 1946, was done out in the Marshall Islands. And that's where you had like a whole bunch of ships all brought in, and they dropped a bomb, which landed above the ships. They also put a bomb underwater, about 150 feet, I believe, somewhere around that, underwater, and that exploded. And they found that that exploding a bomb underwater and creating a lot of steam and mixing in with the water became extremely radioactive. I'm not sure if they were totally prepared for that, but during the whole atmospheric testing program, they improved their techniques of trying to protect people. I'm sorry. Was there another part of the question that I didn't know?
Well, I do want to. I think the caller raised this interesting point, and it was one of the things that I wanted to ask about there were a lot of people. There were soldiers, and there were other people that were exposed to radiation because they were near, or they were around, or were involved in these kinds of tests. And I, I've seen some of the photos of some of these cameramen who were, I'm not sure how close they were, but it seemed that they were rather frighteningly close. They're just in their shirt sleeves. And so I was, and there has been, back in 1990, there was a federal act passed to pay compensation to people who said that they were injured as a result of being exposed to radiation associated with these tests. So I'm wondering, well, what exactly happened to these men? Do we know, for example, did an unusual number of them end up with cancer? Did they suffer health effects as a result of doing the work?
Well, I got to know quite a few of them over the last few years, and many of them are now gone. And I'm not sure I could say with any kind of definite feeling that that they eventually died of some cancer that related to the atomic bomb. They all lived fairly long lives. In fact, most of them lived longer than my parents. So I generally tend to think anyone who you know, made it past 70, you know, had a good long life. There were times when some of the guys that I knew, one particular Charlie Wyckoff, who had worked for a company called EG&G, which did a lot of the technical photography along with Lookout Mountain. He was a very brilliant guy, and I was talking to him one day and said, well, I've been in for a checkup, and I've got every kind of cancer you could think of, and, you know, within a few weeks he was gone. You know, it's not something that I could definitely say one way or the other, but your caller was mentioning strontium 90, which was one of the isotopes, I think, byproducts of atomic bombs, which was considered fairly problematic when it came to, you know, the various byproducts. Another one, if we've been listening to the news recently, is like iodine, I think, 131. And these are all things that, you know, basically floated around, became part of the food chain. Strontium 90 and like iodine 131, the issue with a lot of these radioactive problems comes from the fact that, you know, your body is always trying to take up minerals, vitamins, and things to help your body go along. Now, strontium 90 is a lot like calcium, and you know, your body needs calcium. And from what I've been able to determine, you know, if your body is lacking something and it doesn't have enough calcium available to it, and there's strontium 90 floating around, it'll say, "Look, I'll take the strontium 90 because it's as close to calcium as I can find," and then it becomes part of your bones, and especially children, you know, children who are growing and need, you know, new bones, or their bones are growing, you know, and then it, then you've just got something that, an isotope built into your bones, and that's not, you know, that can lead to things like bone cancer. Now, you know, I've just learned these things as I've gone along. There's definitely issues, and that's why they stopped testing.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that in the course of doing this work, being that you are a filmmaker and not a physicist or an MD, you probably did end up picking up some physics and some working knowledge of what the health effects of radiation are, just in the course of having worked with this subject for all of these years.
Sure.
Well, I tell you what, we have about 10 minutes left. We have a couple of callers.
Okay.
Let's go on. We'll take one more caller. And then you provided us a piece of audio that I think would be really interesting for people to hear. So we want to play that in a bit. So, but let me go on to another caller here, Belgium, not too far away from here, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning, gentlemen. My father was one of those military individuals who was at those tests. He's 88. He doesn't seem to have any cancer and stuff. He has other physical problems, but no cancer. So I think your point about the military seems to be a bit more protected. It is probably true. But the question I really wanted to ask you, you said you films of all the ones out in the islands and stuff like that in South Pacific. Did you have many films of anybody who took the pictures of the ones that went off in Nevada in the 50s? Because they would go off and people would go outside and watch them. You know, obviously they didn't see them close by. They were very distant, but they still lit up the sky and stuff, because I can remember them talking about those sort of things. Were there ever pictures or films of by general
sure.
individuals?
Sure, absolutely. The the film Trinity and Beyond and some of the other ones basically identify and show not just tests that were done out in the Pacific, but tests that were done in Nevada. During that time, you know, originally what happened was they wanted to go as far away from the United States as possible and do the testing out in Bikini or in Aweetok out in the Marshall Islands. And the first set of tests, 1946, 1947, were all done out in the Pacific. After that, somewhere around 1951, which was when the Nevada test site was basically launched, they decided, you know, there's a lot of logistics in terms of going out to the Pacific and doing all of these tests. Maybe we can do the smaller tests out in Nevada. So that's why they, you know, basically came up with the Nevada test site. And usually it was to do much smaller bomb tests. Something that I wanted to point out was that, you know, the difference between, like, say you're seeing a hydrogen bomb explode out in the Pacific or seeing a regular bomb explode in the Nevada test site, you know, how long it took for the sound and the shockwave to come and hit you. Out in the Pacific, you know, you would see a test go off, and it could take up to 2 minutes before you actually heard the bomb resonate and feel the shockwave out in the Nevada test site. It was usually a lot closer, and it could be 30 seconds. I think the test that you're going to hear on the on this recording is actually much closer. You know, from the time that the bomb actually goes off to the time that you hear it is actually much closer. But all of the films deal with the tests in the Pacific and the tests in Nevada. Yeah.
We're really getting short on time. I just want to make sure that we have enough time to play this because I think it'll be really interesting for people to hear. You just want to talk for a moment about what it is now that people are going to hear.
Sure. This is something I actually just acquired like 2 days ago, and I wanted to hear listeners to hear it. It's a recording that was actually made what they called Ground Zero. Five guys were standing there. This is in 1957, and an air-to-air rocket was shot off about 10,000 feet over their head, and you can hear them say that they saw the light, they can feel the heat, and then you actually hear the explosion because it took some time for this rocket, which was 10,000 feet above their head, for the shockwave to come and hit them. And so these guys were standing there with a microphone, and it said Ground Zero, Population 5. And they were volunteers, plus the cameraman, to show, I guess, that if they ever shot an air-to-air rocket up in the sky, that it wasn't necessarily going to hurt anybody. So
okay. Well, let's give a listen to that.
H-minus 1 minute. The airplane is up over our shoulders. It is a bright silver spot in the sky.
Say that I'm going to look away and then I'll find it again.
30 seconds.
I got him.
John sees it. 25 seconds.
Look away and then look back and you'll see it easy.
20 seconds. 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
There it goes.
The rocket is gone. We felt a heat pulse, a very bright light, a fireball. It is red. The sky looks black about it. It is boiling above us there. It is rapidly losing its color. There is the ground wave. It is over, folks. It happened. The mounds are vibrating. It is tremendous. Directly above our heads.
It went.
It went.
Boy, I'd hate to be
good, good. As there is a huge fireball, the rounds are still echoing through here. Worse than that, a perfect, perfect shot.
I think first time in history that bombers will turn back now. Carl Bruce.
The bombers won't come.
Well, I feel this has been a great day for Air Defense Command. There's no question in my mind that that won't do the job that it's designed to do.
Where's the 89?
Namely, completely destroy a bomber at that altitude. There's absolutely no danger for the personnel on the ground here. We did feel the heat momentarily as though one stepped out into the bright sunshine.
Maybe we'll just take that down at that point and get back here with Peter Current. That's really it's both chilling and fascinating. Obviously, you can sense their almost giddy excitement of them, of the thing that they were witnessing, but also they seem to have this feeling that this was, you know, this was part of the American defense structure, and that it was a good thing, and it was something that would protect America from attack.
Yeah, this was actually when they were saying, okay, well, bombs are going to be delivered by Soviet bombers. You know, Soviet bombers are going to come over and they're going to drop their bombs, and this was an attempt to say, you know, this is our defense. After that was when bombs were actually put on missiles and ICBMs, and were able to be launched that way. So they didn't really need the bombers anymore, you know. This air-to-air missile certainly wasn't going to do anything about an ICBM that's traveling at very, very fast speed. So, you know, it all kind of it evolved, you know, the whole process evolved after that.
Well, let's try and get one more caller in here. Urbana, line one. Hello. Let's call there, Urbana, line
yes,
one.
I'm here.
Yeah, go ahead, yes.
Yeah, that audio was really kind of creepy, actually. But I was going to mention, this is sort of related. There's a book by George Weller, edited by his son, first into Nagasaki, where he was a reporter, I think, for AP, the Associated Press, and went within 4, 5, 6 days after the bomb. And all of his stuff is confiscated except for the carbons. And his son found a box of carbons after he died, so they reconstituted his notes. And there's an immediacy about this book that is amazing. So, but actually, what he was doing was looking for POWs there, because he would say, "Oh, there's a British guy," and he'd ask who he was. And it's very interesting post-bomb. But there are some photos in there, and I'm not sure whether I'm sure they were declassified. But I thought I'd mention that to the listeners if they're interested. But your work sounds interesting. I've seen some of these explosions on the web. And but also I wanted to mention that the Blue Waters computer here is sponsored by DARPA and the AEC, or NRC, or whatever it is now. And they're going to use it to model explosions, nuclear weapons explosions. So I don't know if people know that. But thanks, David. Great show.
Okay. Thank
Bye-bye.
You. We're coming down here, but we have about a minute or so left. And I'm sure there are a lot of things we talk about, including your other work, the work that you did and you have done as a special effects guy in movies. So, you know, who knows? Maybe sometime we could talk a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Just let me, though, you know, is there some particular thought here you'd like to leave with folks? And then, of course, well, I'll mention again the fact that if people would like to see some excerpts of one of Peter Curran's films, it will be shown on the campus tomorrow night. This is Hollywood's top secret film studio about the Lookout Mountain Laboratory and the man who filmed nuclear explosions. And that's tomorrow night, room 66, Main Library, 7 o'clock.
I'd like to mention that my book, How to Photograph an Atomic Bomb, is now on an iPad version. And for the next couple of days for this event, I put it at half price, which is like $4.99. You can go to my website at adamcentral.com, and it'll take you to iTunes to be able to purchase the book if you're interested.
And this has some still photographs of the kinds of things that we're talking about?
Sure, and the nice thing about the iPad is that I was able to put in the motion images too, so you can basically do what they call scrubbing back and forth and looking at motion as well as just still photography. It's about 140 pictures, I think, in general.
So do you think now, we talked earlier about the fact that there is a lot of material that's still classified, that the government is holding, that there had been an effort to try to get it declassified and that had stopped. Do you think that at some point that more of this material will be publicly available?
Honestly, the best person to ask is Dr. Ristvedt, who's going to be there tomorrow night. He is, he's on the forefront of being able to declassify material. Hopefully more and more will be declassified. And I think the government, in a way, likes to have material declassified because when something is considered secret or top secret, you know, anybody entering a building, you know, where they have secret material, they have to go through a lot of effort to make sure that, you know, it's not out lying around or that the people aren't given access to it. So, mm-hmm. So in a way, anything that can be declassified, I think, is actually a good thing to their process.
All right. Well, again, this is tomorrow night on the U of I campus at 7 o'clock, and one of the guests there will be Byron Ristvedt. He is Assistant for Nuclear Matters with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency of the Department of Defense and has had a lot of experience with working with nuclear tests and test sites and matters of proliferation. And also you can see some of Hollywood's top secret film studio, one of a number of documentaries on the subject of atomic history made by our guest, Peter Curran. And Mr. Curran, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.